Hello, my name is Wendy Holden and welcome to my podcast. Today I'll be talking about one of my books, Lady Blue Eyes, a memoir of Barbara Sinatra, the widow of the legendary singer Frank. Frank Sinatra is often described as the singer of the century, and few could argue that Old Blue Eyes, as he became known, was unsurpassed in terms of both his popularity and output during his lifetime. This mercurial, complicated, unreconstructed man still commands worldwide fascination more than 20 years after his death. His love affairs, his friendships, and his business partners have come under intense scrutiny, and not all of it entirely flattering. I have been a fan of Sinatra's music since my early 20s. Songs like Fly Me to the Moon, New York, New York, and One for the Road feature regularly on my playlists. So it was with considerable curiosity that in 2009 I accepted the commission to write the memoir of Barbara Sinatra, Frank's fourth and final wife, and the woman with whom he spent his last 26 years before dying in her arms in 1998. Who else, I thought, but his widow could set the record straight and speak of Frank so honestly, writing an open love letter to her adored husband, whilst at the same time bravely revealing him as a fully rounded individual, brilliantly talented, yet utterly human, warts and all. Imagine my surprise when I discovered that Barbara's life before Frank was equally as fascinating and could have merited a book all by itself. My admiration for her grew in leaps and bounds, and from our very first encounter at her Los Angeles penthouse, we became firm friends. Barbara Ann Blakely was born soon after the Great Depression on March 10, 1927, in small town Bosworth, Missouri. Tall, skinny, and with pigtails, her happiest days were spent in her grandfather's general store, where the all-male members of the so-called Spit and Argue Club sat in wooden chairs around the pot-bellied stove, chewing tobacco, sipping strong coffee, and complaining about the price of corn. Her unhappiest days were spent trapped in the clammy storm cellar with her parents and sister, hiding from the region's many vicious cyclones. Barbara's fate may well have been to spend her life in that isolated town of 500 souls, but for her mother Irene, a fearless beauty who was unusual in the town not only because she wore makeup, read glossy magazines, and watched Hollywood movies, but she was also the only female smoker in Bosworth. Constantly telling her two daughters that they needed to escape and find themselves a more meaningful life, Irene felt stifled by her marriage to Barbara's father, Willis, a taciturn butcher, and desperate to follow her two sisters, who'd married American airmen and were living on air bases in what seemed to her like exotic places. Eventually, she got her way, moving to where her sisters were then posted in Wichita, Kansas, and the rest of her family went unhappily in tow. The transition to a big city was a shock for everyone, not least Barbara, who towered over the other children at school and discovered to her horror that she spoke with a different accent. She quickly dropped her rural twang and blossomed into a teenage beauty. Desperate to embrace the wartime free-for-all mentality, she was surprised to be curbed by her mother, who imposed strict curfews the likes of which she'd never known. Feeling trapped and unhappy, Barbara dyed her hair red and frequently escaped from her room, shimmying down a drainpipe and sneaking to the local drive-in to listen with a sigh to romantic songs on the jukebox as Sinatra mania gripped the country. When her sisters' husbands were posted next to Long Beach, California, Irene Blakely insisted that the whole family up sticks again. This was the first time Barbara had ever seen the ocean. At 18, she was accepted to a local modelling school where, at 5 feet 8 inches tall, she was considered the perfect height. Having won a local beauty pageant, she was soon wooed by Bob Oliver, a good-looking young singer from a large Italian family, who dropped to his knees and asked her to marry him on their first date. She accepted only when he was offered work in New York a few months later, and she didn't want him to go alone. His friend Nat King Cole played at their wedding before they took off for Mexico on their honeymoon, where she quickly realised that she'd made a mistake as she watched Bob drinking and flirting openly with other women. New York in 1949 was a revelation to the Missouri farm girl who'd dyed her hair blonde by then to mimic the actress Lana Turner. She quickly found work as a model while Bob knocked on doors seeking more gigs, often without success. During one of her first assignments, a 10-day photo shoot on a cruise to the Bahamas, Barbara met a young Jack Kennedy who was smitten with her, but she had other things on her mind. She was pregnant. Keeping it secret, she was signed with a top modelling agency and secured work for Vogue and Life magazines until her condition became apparent and she was fired. Unemployed and broke, she and Bob returned unhappily to California, where they moved in above her parents' in-law's Italian restaurant, while he worked as a bartender and gambled away what little money they had left. Setting up her own modelling, deportment and elocution school with a loan from her mother-in-law saved Barbara's sanity as her baby grew inside her. Business flourished, but Bob kept hitting on her students and drunkenly demanding the cash she was saving for their baby. Their son Bobby was born in 1950 after a two-day labour that Bob left because he couldn't bear her screams. When he flew back to New York to pursue his singing career soon afterwards, Barbara knew that their marriage was effectively over. With help from her mother, sister, and doting mother-in-law, she continued to expand her school, launched her own cosmetics line, and was signed up as a beauty consultant to the first ever Miss Universe contest. Bob returned from New York to leer at the contestants and talk his way into becoming a pageant executive. He also set himself up as a promoter for a singer and TV presenter called Joe Graydon, who invited Barbara and her models onto his show. Bob, meanwhile, continued to gamble and womanise, leaving Barbara for weeks on end. Unhappy, she fell into Joe's arms, and after Bob found out, he emptied her bank account and left her penniless once more. When Joe was offered a new TV show in San Diego, Barbara relocated with him, leaving Bobby with his adoring grandmothers and the modelling school in the hands of her sister. As well as appearing regularly on Joe's show, Barbara worked in TV commercials, driving back to Long Beach every weekend to see her son. Then Joe lost his job and could only find work in Las Vegas, so in 1956 she followed him there too, picking up work as a model at the Sahara and Flamingo hotels. After she secured a job as a showgirl at the prestigious Riviera, she moved her son to Vegas, hired a childminder, modelled during the day, and at night she glided across a stage wearing a towering headdress featuring anything from the Statue of Liberty to the Eiffel Tower. A flagship of the glamorous Riviera fleet, Barbara caught the eye of every man she met, from Howard Hughes to Elvis Presley, from mafia hitmen to Frank Sinatra, who called out one night from a bar, "Hey, Blondie, come on in here," when he spotted her leaving. That night, she kept on walking. Sadly, her relationship with Joe began to founder when he lost his job again because of his drinking, leaving her to juggle work and parenthood. The town known as Sin City was fast losing its glamour by the time Barbara happened upon a laundry basket full of blood-soaked sheets following another mafia hit, and then history repeated itself when Joe emptied her bank account. Just as she was wondering what to do next, a new suitor appeared on the horizon. Zeppo Marx was the good-looking former straight man member of the wacky Marx Brothers team of Groucho, Chico and Harpo. At 56, with a fine singing voice, Zeppo had taken early retirement to play at the things he enjoyed most: gambling, women, golf, and inventing mechanical things. He was successful at all four, especially the last, which made him more money than any other pursuit ever did. Divorced, with two adopted sons, he was carefree and single, with lots of show business friends and plenty of girls. But now he'd set his sights on Barbara. Zeppo's arrival on the scene prompted a Marx Brothers-style comedy sequence where he, Joe Graydon, and Barbara's ex-husband Bob all turned up at one of her shows on the same night and politely sat together whilst jealously betting on which pair of legs was hers in a lineup where the showgirls' faces were hidden behind a curtain. Having insisted she was the lowest high kicker, Zeppo won the bet and eventually the girl. But not yet, as Barbara first left Las Vegas for Long Beach, seeking a more independent way of life. It didn't work out, and she was a struggling single parent when Zeppo invited her to Palm Springs in 1958, and she accepted. He asked her to marry him, and when she refused on the grounds that she didn't love him, he set her up in her own apartment before paying for Bobby, her son, to attend a private military school back in Los Angeles, largely to get him out of the way. As before, Barbara drove to visit Bobby every weekend. While she became known as a desert rat and worked as a model in poolside fashion shows, Zeppo gambled, played golf, and hung out with his crazy brothers, Groucho, Gummo, Chico, and Harpo, who was mute and often remained under a table at parties. Zeppo introduced her to his celebrity friends, including Danny Kaye, and to his next-door neighbour, Frank Sinatra. After a brief spell back in LA working as a model, Barbara finally accepted Zeppo's proposal, and they were married at the Riviera in Vegas in 1959. She was 32 years old, and he was 58. Zeppo bought himself a new yacht and named it the Barbara Ann in her honour, but he wasn't otherwise overly lavish with his gifts and didn't want her to have her own money. He was also insanely jealous of other men. Bored, Barbara learned to play golf, improved her tennis game, and became close friends with the singer Dinah Shore, the actress Janet Leigh and her husband Tony Curtis, as well as Kirk and Anne Douglas and Gregory and Veronique Peck. She also mingled with the likes of Marilyn Monroe, Clark Gable, George Burns, and appeared as a model on the Jack Benny Show. When Frank Sinatra's ex-wife, the troubled actress Ava Gardner, came to Palm Springs for a visit, Frank built a tennis court at his house especially for her and asked Barbara to organise a few games. Ava was drunk on Moscow mules before the match even began, and all Frank did was flirt outrageously with Barbara to make Ava jealous, while she in turn flirted with the tennis pro. After that, Frank started to spend more time in Palm Springs and repeatedly invited Zeppo and Barbara to his many parties. Zeppo repeatedly refused, so Frank would send over a case of fine wine or champagne with notes that read, "Because it's a new moon," or "As it's Tuesday." When Barbara organised an exclusive movie screening for a local children's cancer hospital, but a glitch meant that Spartacus couldn't be shown, Frank gallantly stepped in at the 11th hour and provided an early cut of a movie he'd just completed called Come Blow Your Horn. Barbara's gratitude would be lifelong, and Zeppo couldn't possibly continue to refuse his party invitations after Frank had been so helpful. Before too long, a frisson developed between Barbara and Frank, which she resisted at first, not least because of Zeppo's jealous temper. In the ensuing years, Frank went on to marry his third wife, Mia Farrow, briefly, and life in Palm Springs continued much as before. Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor dropped in, only to have a furious row when Richard complimented Barbara's legs, and the desert rats were visited by President Kennedy and then shattered by his assassination in 1963. 5 years later, history repeated itself with JFK's brother Bobby, with whom Barbara played tennis. Her marriage to Zeppo became increasingly unhappy as she suspected him of cheating, and she also hated how Zeppo treated her son. Matters finally came to a head when Bobby ran away from home and Barbara caught Zeppo on the Barbara Ann with dozens of girls. When Frank took a break from performing in 1971, he spent even more time in Palm Springs, flirting increasingly with Barbara. When he first kissed her at a party held by Ava Gabor, she felt happy for the first time in years. When he followed her to Monaco that summer, their fate was sealed, and Barbara's secret affair with Francis Albert began. Her marriage to Zeppo finally failed, and Barbara moved out and into a small house that Frank bought for her. From that day on, she was at his side, at everything from galas at the White House to the annual Red Cross charity ball hosted by Frank's great friend, Princess Grace of Monaco. Barbara frequently witnessed Frank's infamous trigger temper, but also his extraordinary generosity to friends and complete strangers. She learned that he was an insomniac who liked to hold his guests hostage to stay up and drink Jack Daniels with him. She loved that he read so avidly and completed the cryptic crossword in ink every day. A great cook who was happiest at home with her, his pets and his train set, he was also the most particular person she had ever met about hygiene, manners, punctuality and style, and she was staggered to discover that he was a prolific and talented artist. In 1973, after a two-year break, Frank returned to the studio and cut Old Blue Eyes' back. Then in 1974, he started touring again, with Barbara in tow, as he spun her around the world over the next few years. She adored every minute, especially when the most romantic man she'd ever met lavished her with expensive jewellery and other gifts, sang directly to her from the stage, or made sure to tell her last thing at night, every night, "I love you." Thrown together 24/7, however, there were also tensions, and on a couple of occasions, she left him. After each breather, though, he would always persuade her to go back. By 1976, worried about his long-term commitment, Barbara gave Frank an ultimatum: marry me or lose me. He faltered, so she broke up with him again and waited for the call she hoped would come. It did, a few weeks later from Chicago, where he was drowning his sorrows, and he sent a plane for her. Once there, instead of formally proposing, he filled her hotel room with bouquets of flowers before tossing two enormous gemstones in the middle of the bed, a 22-carat pear-shaped diamond and a similarly large emerald. "You can have them set any way you want," he told her. It was the closest to a proposal she was going to get. When the stone she chose was finally set, Frank dropped the diamond ring into a champagne glass and told her to put it on. "No," she said, knowingly, holding out both her hands. "You put it on, Frank. Put it any place you want." Shaking his head and laughing, Frank admitted defeat and placed it onto her left ring finger. Barbara Ann Blakely married 60-year-old Frank Sinatra in Palm Springs in July 1976 in what was described as the wedding of the century. After a blissful honeymoon in Barbados, Barbara had to pinch herself that she was finally Mrs. Frank Sinatra, the wife of the crooner she'd swooned over as a teenager. Her life with him thereafter was nothing short of remarkable, and the people she came to call her friends included presidents and kings, bar owners, musicians, singers, comedians, astronauts, mafia henchmen, princesses, and the world's greatest sportsmen, plus almost all of Hollywood's elite, including Cary Grant, David Niven, Gene Kelly, Sammy Davis Jr., Jack Lemmon, Jimmy Stewart, Dean Martin, and the Reagans. She helped Frank through the death of his beloved mother Dolly in a plane crash. She and Bobby resisted his attempts to adopt him as his son. She made her peace with Zeppo before he died, and it was Barbara who persuaded Frank to record New York, New York. In the course of their 26 years together, Barbara came to know and understand that women would always be part of the deal with Frank. Not only did they throw themselves at him at every opportunity, but he had several female stalkers, including one who broke into their hotel room and cornered her, demanding to see him. Many more claimed he'd fathered their children. Throughout it all, Frank continued to make Barbara feel cherished and secure, inviting her everywhere with him and telling her not to take any notice of the rumours. Whatever temptations he may have faced when she wasn't around, her plan B was to look the other way, if ever she had to. After the disastrous surprise 65th birthday party she threw for him, which he hated, Barbara realised the reason was Frank didn't like the way he was ageing. With thinning hair and intermittent hearing problems, he had a toupee made and surgery on a punctured eardrum. He also had stomach problems caused by his drinking and lifestyle, and he worried that his voice was losing its magic. Nevertheless, he carried on working and touring for the next 10 years, with Barbara by his side. She was with him when he met the Pope and the Queen, and was in the wings at his concerts in the Middle East, Europe, Japan and Africa, and most memorably in Rio de Janeiro in 1980, when he finally went to Brazil, a place where he was revered to an almost religious extent. In 1986, Barbara and Frank opened the Barbara Sinatra Children's Centre in Palm Springs for child victims of sexual abuse, funded by those Barbara had persuaded to part with millions. Frank also auctioned many of his best works of art. Right to the end of her life, Barbara, who was honoured for her charity work, maintained a close involvement with the centre and continued to raise funds for it through an annual celebrity golf tournament in Frank's name. In the final years of his life, Frank saw almost all the people he knew and loved die. Sammy and Dean, Judy Garland, Ronnie Reagan and songwriter Sammy Kahn, to name a few. He was still performing in his 75th year for his Diamond Jubilee tour, and then he cut his first new album in a decade with his Grammy-winning duets, in which he sang with Stevie Wonder, Willie Nelson, Neil Diamond and Gladys Knight, among others. Aged 78, he collapsed on stage with exhaustion, but was soon back on the road, pushing himself to the limit. It took Barbara a long time to persuade him to take it easy, but in his 80th year, he finally agreed to sell up in Palm Springs and move to their house in LA after giving his final performance in 1995 for her annual charity gala. In the summer of 1996, Barbara and Frank both wept as they renewed their wedding vows in a little church in Malibu on their 20th anniversary. Both sensed that time was running out. The event marked a celebration of their many happy years together, but also the start of Frank's final decline. Without the need to get up and go to work, his health and spirits suffered, and his hearing, sight and cognitive function deteriorated. He was frequently rushed to hospital for problems with his breathing, heart or blood pressure, and then he developed bladder cancer and dementia. The press hounded the couple everywhere they went, even at hospital, so Barbara would cover Frank's head with a scarf, hide him on the back seat, or mask the windows of their private ambulance with foil. Friends were openly asked to contribute to his obituary long before he died, and the paparazzi set up permanent camp opposite their home, hoping for the last photo of Frank Sinatra. Barbara was so taken up with caring for him that she didn't even tell him she tripped over one of their dogs and broke several bones in her back. Wearing a steel brace, she pretended she was okay as she continued to supervise his 24-hour care. Francis Albert Sinatra died on May 14, 1998, after being rushed to hospital with a suspected heart attack. He was 83 years old. Barbara was clasping his hand as he breathed his last, urging him to keep on fighting. His final words to her were, "I can't." His funeral was attended by hundreds and watched by thousands, and then his body was flown back to Palm Springs to be interred alongside his parents and many of their closest friends. His simple marker reads, "The best is yet to come." Barbara's grief was lifelong and deeply private, despite having to share him with the world, and she played his music from morning till night. Whenever I visited her at any of her beautiful homes in Los Angeles, Palm Springs or Malibu, she put me in a guest suite filled with Frank's art and surrounded by photos of the two of them. She'd have her staff create a special martini on my honour each time, and even if she was too unwell to get up, we'd lie on her bed and watch Cary Grant, David Niven or Greg Peck movies with the volume turned down while she told me one wonderful story after another about them. Every year on the anniversary of Frank's death, Barbara visited the desert cemetery where he's buried to lay some flowers before telling her sweetheart how much she missed him. Each time she had to smile because his devoted fans had usually got there before her. Frank's grave is one of the easiest to spot amongst the hundreds under the lush grass carpet. Placed lovingly around it are miniature bottles of Jack Daniels, packets of Camel cigarettes, his favourite candies, poses of flowers, and tiny American flags. Barbara Ann Sinatra died on July 25, 2017, at the age of 90. I saw her 3 months earlier, soon after her 90th birthday, at her home in Palm Springs. She was as glamorous as ever, even though she was painfully thin and in a wheelchair, but her sparkly enthusiasm for life never left her. We had our customary martini together and reminisced once more. She was laid to rest alongside her beloved Frank, constantly surprised by her great good fortune at finding so much love and happiness with the man she'd once melted over as a girl. I once asked her what her epitaph might be, having thought about the long line of relatives and friends she'd be joining at the Desert Memorial Park Cemetery. She laughed and suggested, "And me too?" Dear Barbara, I miss her to this day.